I want to talk about George Johnson. Sounds a fairly ordinary person, but he had an extraordinary run of, I suppose, a wannabe on the First Fleet. So he's a key person. He attracts me. I find him very interesting because he's a very... with no offence to his descendants, who are still running around Australia, is a very weak and flawed character. And his weaknesses and flaws set Australia in a very complex path. So I hope you find that interesting. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I podcast usefully during my cardiac walks. I've already done one podcast. And the idea is that I'm a teacher and I want to get used to just talking off the top of my head and holding conversation, one-sided, and making it a bit more coherent. It's a bit like Toastmasters if you've got no friends. So get back to George Johnson. He was a soldier. There's a lot of racket out here in the Australian bush, like I'm actually out in the national park, but there's people at the back with loud music playing. It's a bit of a tragedy for the animals and everything around here. Okay, so back to George Johnson. I think born 1764, around that time. He had to be because he fought in the American Revolution, so he was he got a taste of the British Army and the confusion of the British Army and the trying to actually take on the Americans, which really outfoxed them at every point. So after fighting, I'm just really going off the top of my head, so this is deep memory here. I think Georgetown, New York, these are words that come to my head. But he returned to Britain, obviously, because he wasn't... there's not much work for the British Army after they lost in the American Revolution, and still retained in a job in the Army as a recruiter. So he would recruit people into his regiment. It's interesting that the regiments were still allied with the British nobility, which supported the king, which is, you know, sort of an interesting aspect. So for a number of years he acted as a recruiter, and I find this very interesting because he would act as an interface between the community and the army, and just try and ease people into this life. This is an important point. War was erupting in France. I suppose it would be the French Revolution. The British were fighting there, and then he went to this part of the world, not to Australia, but he went to the French East Indies on a ship called the Sultan. Now, remember that Sultan is part of his story. He was in the ship, and he was on evidently such a crack soldier, and he got severely wounded and returned to Britain. They're getting people together with the French, with the First Fleet, some 1,300 people, 1,000 happy people who are going to stay in Australia, 300 tour bus operators, 11 buses all that up, if you like to say, or 11 smaller ships to come out to Australia in 1788. And reportedly, he, knowing the momentum and the politics of the time, was the first person on the shore at Sydney Cove. He made sure he's building sort of a bit of a name for himself. And he was in the New South Wales regiment, or the actual professional British soldiers that were there. And so that's, I think, made up about 100 or close on 200 soldiers. I don't know whether we count them as in the group of the First Fleeters, because they were there as British soldier guards and then left. So I don't know whether people count them as First Fleeters. So there was a bit of a corporate psychopath, Ross, in the regiment. He was so bad that people actually wanted to stay in Australia. They'd prefer to risk starvation, risk everything, never see England again, because England had this particular commander of the soldiers was so upsetting. And I've got to really think this Philip, the governor at the time, said, gave Johnson the task of getting a sort of a semi-professional militia, the New South Wales Regiment, together. So I'm going to try and speed this up a little bit. So he's close in the organisation of the colony. We had Bligh come down, mutiny on the Bounty. So Bligh, there's so much history there. Bligh, unfortunately, went to Australia via Tahiti. Tahiti was the Love Isles, they were free love. He was actually trying to get, I think, bread plants to actually bring them from Tahiti to, eventually through the British colonies, back to their Caribbean possessions, because according to Banks, these bread plants were the food of the future. So that got Bligh up to Tahiti. There's a bit of a story there. I'm trying to remember the protagonist, the person who committed, who was the mutineer, but he fell in love with a Tahitian woman, and he was humiliated as he by Bligh, who sort of ruled, managed by humiliation and intimidation, probably not the best way of doing things in our modern world. They had to stop in various islands, and by this stage the islanders were beginning to work out, we'll get back to George Johnson, but the islanders were beginning to work out how to really spook the British when they arrived. And so they would go up in the hills where they couldn't hear it and just crack rocks together all throughout the night. This would send them a bit stir crazy. And when Christian, this is the mutineer who had his bottom tattooed black. That's an interesting anecdote. So the Tahitians tattooed his bottom black. He was a bit spooked. Bligh told him off, was not a good man manager, and the mutiny happened. So Bligh arrived in Australia to take over the governorship. So the governors weren't hanging around in Australia, they were professional administrators. And this is really, for many, many years, the governors would do a tour, being a famous governor in Australia. So it's a bit hard for us to be proud of our great people, because they didn't hang around. They said, well, you've got a way to go. So it's a bit hard to do it. So Bligh came along. He had, by then, there was a government house in Parramatta. So the capital of Australia was back upriver. Now, this is because the military were running the place, and the military knew that if you put your capital on the shores, a navy could come around with just a gunboat and blow you away and take it over. The British know this because they were doing this all the time to other countries, so they had this general idea of placing capitals back upstream. So this is interesting in the founding of Adelaide, which had a military person doing it. Besides the fact where they first landed, having too many mosquitoes, they moved further inland, and this was seen as a good strategic idea, because it would make it very difficult to take Adelaide if it's a few kilometres inland. So there's Bligh in Parliament House, and George Johnson's going to come into shore. He's comes across, if you read the first documents about him, you get a bit of an impression of him. But by then, this granting system where the government gave you land, well, this is an open ticket for bullies and corrupt people. And MacArthur, who is going to make a killing out of sheep and wool, in the Sydney Basin area knew that he didn't actually want to be governor and made George Johnson the governor after they rebelled, the Rum Rebellion, and got rid of the British administration. So Australia was in rebellion for a while, not as successful as the United States, and it was called the Rum Rebellion. So Bligh, when they were staging the coup, actually was found hiding out of his bed by George Johnson, and actually sent packing on a ship, and he went down to Hobart where he harassed another poor individual. George Johnson, I can't quite remember, there was also the Irish Rebellion, and he played a point in that, so I can't remember the history, whether this actually happened. I think it happened before the Rum Rebellion. But the important thing here is, and again, if you don't read the histories, you don't see the effect, the magnetic effect of the Americans. There was American whaling boats up the Parramatta River, and the Irish thought, this is our chance we can get out of this hellhole of Australia. And you've got to remember that when people talk down Australia, they did it for a reason, because it was a prison. So you don't want to say, come to a sunny Australia, land of opportunity. It's supposed to be a prison, end of the earth. And so when there was a... just looking at what's here behind me. Oh, sorry. When there was a... sorry, it's actually quite dark out here in the Australian bush. I'll have to get back in at some stage. Okay. So we've got George Johnson. He's kicked out Bligh and... with MacArthur, convinces him to be the governor, de facto governor, of a rebellion colony. Of course, they know they've only got a certain amount of time before the actual professional British Army come, because, the British Army weren't going to take too much nonsense, and it's rather disappointing when it comes across. But swapping now to the Strawberry Hill Irish Rebellion. You've got the American whaling boats, the Sniff of Freedom, and so the Irish rebel, and they actually steal arms, and they have an intellectual who rides up on a horse to meet George Johnson, to parley the authority, the just one thing, I think it's before the Rum Rebellion. But the important thing is that George Johnson meets this other person in a paddock, both on horseback, and George Johnson just pulls out a pistol and blows him away. Forgets it, and that finishes the rebellion. Well, not quite. There's other things. I suppose the important thing is that when you read this stuff, the big embarrassing mystery is that no one can really shoot anybody. So they stole arms, but they didn't know how to use it, being the poor people. So going forward or backwards, I think it must be forward in history. George Johnson is the governor of Australia, the rebel governor of Australia. Very important, this story. So he's been a recruiter, a spin doctor. He's there, weak, powerful people using him, and they start actually getting him to mint grants of land. And importantly, around here, he gave a grant of land just on his last day of office before he just got petrified and ran away. He gave a grant of land of Emu River to his son, a large area in Emu River. Now, Emu River is the actual locality that I'm in. I'm in Glenbrook, which is next to Emu Plains. Now, rather than... did I say Emu River? I mean Emu Island. So it was known as Emu Island until surveyors came across with Macquarie, who's the professional replacement governor, to get everything under control. He's the governor you pick when you want to stop a revolution, rebellion. And... he came along and said, hang on, there's only one river here. How is it an island? And they said, we've mucked it up. It's actually just not an island. So they now call that area Emu Plains. That's the origin of it. And I just to steal the story, Macquarie said, and how do you own this? Oh, well, my dad, who was the governor, the rebel governor, gave me the land on this piece of paper. Oops. And Macquarie said, oh, I've got some land now. I'll give it to one of my friends. So that's the story around this area. It's all happening or not happening, so to speak. Now, the important thing is that George Johnson then went back to Britain. And he sort of, Mark Cooper, just pleaded as a very weak person with the British authorities. And they were going to try him and let's see. Oh, we hang people for not very much these days. And it was definitely a military court and the gallows for him. But again, I'm just reading sources. I don't know whether they're true or false. I read them for entertainment, not for podcasting at the stage. He waited until the magistrate was sick. And then they got the ruling and he got cashiered from the army. And this is really relevant. So he's over here. He's given a lot of land to his family, his wife in particular. I think he's the first Jewish person in Australia, a very successful businesswoman. I'm sure there's many Jewish people in the first fleet. I'm sorry about that if I've got that wrong. That's right. Yeah, he wasn't actually married to this woman. This is another aspect of it. So it's the partner. This is important later on in the story. And so he gets cashiered by the army. And what happens is, cashiered is something which wouldn't bother me a bit. What they do is they get your officer's sword and snap it on their knee. Now, I don't know how they do that, because swords myself would cut your hands on it. They shouldn't snap, but somehow they know how to snap swords on your knee. And they go in front of all the regiment and they rip your epaulets off and everyone blows raspberries at you. Now, I don't know, for a modern Australian, that would just, you just laugh at it. But for him, it was quite serious and he had nowhere to go. So he went back to Australia, and this is with Macquarie running the shop. And Macquarie had to try and get the colony back on its feet. They said, look, you can be around the place, George Johnson. But the one thing is, you can't mention anything to do with your military career. In fact, you're just a really annoying person. You can't speak to me. And so this, I find, is quite interesting. That's my spin, just reading the documents from Macquarie. Just really couldn't stand this man. Obviously, he was the person that caused all this problem he's replacing, but somehow he'd weaseled himself in. But he was still quite a wealthy Australian, because a lot of corruption goes on the growing of Australia. So Australia celebrates its corrupt people who just steal land. We call them squatters, you know, lovely squatter. And of course, there's a romantic view of these people. Of course, these people, if they're stealing land in the first place, they're not high moral people. They're not, you know, they haven't got a good eye for the law at this stage. So they tend to take from, I suppose, the Aboriginals, but they also take from each other, so they're quite difficult people. So what I really like about this, and this is good for having a good memory, he decides to give a horse to Macquarie. Macquarie's quite pleased. What's the name of this horse? Sultan. Ah, but can I tell you, that's the name of the ship that I was in and I got wounded in. But so I can imagine. So there's all that aspect of it. I think he dies. I think his wife is Esther E. something or other. I really can't remember it. This is off the top of my head. This is all off the top of my head. But she eventually has dementia, as happens a lot when you actually read into the history of these people in the First Fleet. You can read what's going on. I have to stop at this time. It's 90 minutes. I could stop for another incredible story. So, being, I suppose, a person who can pick up details. I was walking in the New South Wales Parliament. There is a story here. George Johnston, he's died. His wife's got a... he's left descendants, and I apologise to any descendants I meet around today. Good guy. Very interesting person. So he's had this very sort of funny coming back to Australia. Now we're changing scene here, and hopefully this is me being a better podcaster, to me, an Aussie, walking into a colonial building in the centre of Sydney called Parliament House. And you, as you walk up into the chamber of Parliament House, there's this huge painting called Founding of Australia. And you look at it and your brain sort of goes, pop, 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 all these things are wrong. There's wrong things here. They've chopped down the trees. Why did they chop down the trees? Why are they doing this? Why are they toasting? Why, how? Your brain explodes as you go looking at this painting. And I'll see if I can actually put this on the blog. So this painting, it's sort of like research me. It's a huge monumental painting, sort of 2 meters high, 4 meters across. Now this is big stuff, this is big statement, and this painting is called The Foundation of Australia, and this is almost like a picture of the Australian colonists coming in the first fleet and declaring Australia, founding Australia. It's called The Founding of Australia. So they get out of the boat, George Johnston gets out of the boat first, they build the flag, they have a toast at this point. I'll just stop for a moment. So the basic scene is that you've got the ships out in Sydney Cove, some troops lining up, and everyone, the British flag's up there. I think there's a flag which is historically correct for the time, and there's all these officers and notables up there, and they're raising their glasses, they're toasting the flag. That's interesting. They normally proclaim things, but they started Australia off with a toast, which is sort of rather a strange thing. And when you look at the proclamation, Australia got proclaimed, I think, in February. A few weeks later, they actually had the official proclamation. So this is a reinvention of it. So you go in and you say, oh, this is an interesting picture. Then you see it again, you say, hey, that's a bit different. And what happens is that this picture has been reproduced, but also there's been studies of the picture first, where they've got the picture and they've arranged it. And what's happened is it's been a carefully constructed picture with the actual studies ahead. And what's happened is that people have said, this is not correct, I want you to change this a little bit. And if you've got a good memory, you can look at one, look at the other, say, hey, this is different. And so if you look at by this Cornish painter called A something or other. I really can't remember his name. I do remember where he is on the map, but I can't remember his name. Amarach, something like that. So again, the story starts to unfold. It's a strange painting. I'll give the game away is that if you can superimpose these different paintings, it actually animates the reimagining of the founding of Australia, that point where we lift up the toast. I have to quickly go, and I'll try and do it. Do a GIF of the painting in the front, and you can get various people being a bit more butch, different people, and move back and forward. Someone lifts up their leg. There's a real bloke way. It's real, you can see it's Australian from the first point. So initially they're all British, but the picture a bit later on is a bit more relaxed and Australianised. It's actually quite funny to see. Only the flag would move up and down, but the flag stays at the same point. The ships stay in the same position. I'll put it there. I want to have a little sidestep as into toasting. Now the origin of toast, you can see the way I think, all this information. Let's think about this. The origin of toasting is that toasting is from eating toast. And I think it is that you'd used to be given pretty horrible wine with things floating in it. and you get some toast at the start. And to eat the toast, to clean up the wine before you drink it, you'd actually break up a piece of toast and put the toast in the wine, and it would suck up the little specks, and then you'd eat the toast. So originally, having a toast was actually eating toast. I don't know, I find it quite funny when people say. Okay, getting back to this painting. And there is a huge punchline, you will not believe it. It's sort of like the most, things incredible like this do not happen. The person who actually got this all going was a Kiwi. So this Kiwi actually was on P&O cruises, or cruises between New Zealand and Australia. And as entertainment, back then, raging time, he'd give a lecture on Australian history and the need for Australia Day. Now, this is rather interesting because you got all these notable rich people on these cruises and the place. So you don't have riffraff, and you have like-minded rich people in the age of clubs. So this is around 1930s, between the wars. So Australia, everything was join a club. Your identity was, were you Catholic, were you Mason, were in this club or that club. And his club was the First Fleeters. I might give it away. His name was Hope Johnson. He was the grandson or great-grandson of George Johnson, Hope Johnson. So he was actually Kiwi, and he was trying to relive the story, obviously not without being the rebel-deposed governor and not Kashid. I'm sure he steered people away from things, and he basically started off Australia Day. So if you look at the history of Australia Day, it goes back to this painting and goes back to this Hope Johnson, who got the money together to commission this person, this poor Cornish person who'd never seen Australia. They'd send pictures of Australia out, and he reconstructed. I've had a quick look at pictures of Cornwall to see if there's any similarity in the actual nature that he draws, the rivers and stuff like that. So our key, if you type in to Google the founding of Australia and look at pictures, you'll see this picture right away. So it's interesting that the angst and, I suppose, funny behaviour early on in the colony sort of seeps through time, and you get these other things about emancipists, people are saying, a really interesting debate. There's a brilliant book, you have to read it. I've only seen it once. It's called The Case Against New South Wales. It's a group of people who no longer back in Britain who don't believe in convicts, and are saying how bad New South Wales is. The interesting aspect of it, I think they sent a commission out to Australia, and they said, look, we send them out to Australia, but they've got no morals. They're just having no marriage. It's just absolutely awful. There's multiple partners, the whole thing. We wanted to build a better Australia, but better society, but we're sending them out, and they're just making it up. It's a horrible thing. Now, interesting, diving back into this book, called The Case Against New South Wales, they say that there was in Leningrad, it's a story here, in Leningrad this person was able to run a large architectural firm. These are historical notes, you have to read it and go on with it. So Leningrad, it wasn't Leningrad, it was St. Petersburg back then. He had a large architectural firm, and he had this innovation of putting his controller's desk in the shop and having the backs of everyone in circles around him, so he could control the work of hundreds of architects at the same time. They couldn't turn around because he could see them. So this ideal management idea, and this idea was taken across to the new Dartmoor prisons, the new prisons that they were building in Britain. And so the actual prison building lobby got upset at taking everyone out on boats to Australia. And so it's really interesting that this, the reason that Australia turned away from convicts was, I suppose, a bit due to morals and changing ideas, but it's also due to a new model prison. Oh, I think they were called the new model prisons, the sort of famous prisons that you think of in Britain now. And there's the same design today. This is where all the cells point inwards and you can walk around the outside and keep a good view on everyone. You know, the gap in the floor so you can look down, the screws can look down and up and up there. So there's many things happening here. I suppose the real punchline was that I began to be really interested in how the how little ideas or groups, they don't go away, they sort of go as a cocoon, separate off and sort of exist in history for many, many years and then erupt again to sort of siphon ideas from hundreds of years ago. So I found this interesting in this Hope Johnson guy. There was a story there, family story, and that was cocooned. No one saw anything, but the conditions were right, and he erupted as a spore, sort of a anthrax spore, suddenly setting out Australia Day after this. So it's really interesting to look at the structure of these clubs. And so the first fleeters have a office still in Warramoo, and not Warramoo, Woolloomooloo. That's right. It's just not far from the centre of Sydney, and it's interesting that the actual office holders actually are direct descendants from the First Fleet office holders. So the person in charge of the treasury in the First Fleet is the treasurer of this First Fleet societies, and I think it's Fellowship of the First Fleet. It's sort of a bit like Monty Python's Life of Brian. It's all these splintered groups which don't cooperate each other, which have splintered off the First Fleet. So there's Victorian First Fleet, there's New South Wales First Fleet, there's another First Fleet group, these descendant groups. But this particular First Fleet is a really interesting one because it's got its roots in Sydney clubs from Hope Johnson area. And you walk along to try and find this First Fleet building with all the little First Fleet people still inside it, and you're walking along and you've got the terrace houses, and then all of a sudden you see the front window, and the front window and the front door is the painting. It is the painting of the founding of Australia. It sort of makes sense, but it's sort of like this bizarre experience. You've got this painting, you've researched it, and you've looked at it, and you've looked at all the history of George Johnson and how this has led to different aspects of Australian culture, which I'm not laughing at, I'm just sort of appreciating. And this person is a building in Sydney. I kid you not. The person, really nice people, they open the door, and a door in the painting, and you walk inside. It's the most bizarre thing. And then they've got their library and interesting things, and their computer systems, which you looked at, which is basically two computers with a cable between it. And their main, I suppose, emphasis is contacting people, keeping records, and organising an annual Christmas luncheon. Keeps it all together, and fielding inquiries from odd researchers like myself coming through. So I gave the story before of John Randall, the first African-American, well, I suppose African-American person in the First Fleet. You also have this person called George Johnson. I think there's another Johnson, he's the reverend. There's a few other key people here who stitch together Australian history, and they're all, you know, Bligh, Macquarie, they're all slightly flawed, and they all have a lot of, they've all got different stages of history written into their makeup. So often when you see, say, an Edwardian, reconstruction of Edwardian seeing a film, everyone is at the mean level of cultural development. But when you look at Australia, you've got this big mishmash of people at different levels of cultural development and different things happening. And I just really think it's really fascinating that George Johnson had to reinvent himself and sort of hide in the fleet, coming back to Australia to reinvent himself, and that hiding tension sort of comes throughout history and erupts again in Australia Day and our vision of ourselves as Australian. Well, look, I'm actually getting better walking, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to me. This is Peter Hill signing off, and in the meantime, I suppose keep on researching, I do, and keep on just collecting facts and adding them together. And whatever you do, don't let people tell you why you're doing that. No one's interested in it. It's sometimes the most interesting things are the things that no one is interested in, and they've cast it aside, and you pick up the pieces, and my goodness, you've got this very fascinating story. Bye for now. Peter Hill speaking.